The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the September 2018 edition of Smithsonian Magazine, Secrets of American History. We'll begin today's program with an article titled Codename Venona by Liza Mundy. At the height of the Cold War, America's most secretive counter-espionage effort set out to crack unbreakable Soviet ciphers. Here's the exclusive story of the woman who solved the puzzle. Numbers came easily to Angeline Nani. As a girl of 12 in rural Pennsylvania during the Great Depression, she kept the books in her father's grocery store. In high school, she took all the accounting classes on offer. Enrolled in beauty school after graduation, cosmetology being one of the few fields open to women in the 1940s, Angie focused on the business side while her sisters, Mimi and Virginia, learned to style hair. Before the war, the three Nani sisters had opened a beauty parlor in Blairsville, Pennsylvania, and Angie ran it. So yes, numbers were her calling. But the numbers on this test were like nothing she had ever seen. Angie, intent, graceful, unflappable, was seated in a small classroom in a large, ill-built temporary structure. The year was 1945, and World War II was over. The Nani sisters had moved to Washington, D.C. to take jobs in the war effort, but now the beauty shop in Blairsville beckoned. Angie, though, wanted to stay. This test would determine whether she could. It was being administered at a secret government facility in Arlington, Virginia. Around Angie were 8 or 9 other women, all contemplating the same set of numbers, wearing various expressions of alarm. Most, Angie thought nervously, had attended college. She had not. On a piece of paper before her were 10 sets of numbers, arranged in 5-digit groups. The numbers represented a coded message. Each 5-digit group had a secret meaning. Below that row of 50 numbers was another row of 50, arranged in similar groups. The supervisor told them to subtract the entire bottom row from the top row in sequence. She said something about non-carrying. Angie had never heard the word non-carrying before, but as she looked at the streams of digits, something happened in her brain. She intuited that the digit 4 minus the digit 9 equaled 5, because you just borrow an invisible 1 to go beside the top number. Simple. Angie Nani raced through, stripping out the superfluous figures to get down to the heart of the message. "I don't know how I did it," says Angie, who was 99 years old when we talked in March. "I just said, oh, that's going to be easy." The supervisor came around and saw that she had finished before anybody else. "That's right, Angie, that's right," she cried. Then she ran out of the room to tell her superiors they had a new candidate for the Russian code-breaking project. That moment, and Angie Nani's instinctive grasp of an unusual form of math called non-carrying addition and subtraction, changed the trajectory of her life. It also helped seal the fate of other Americans, such as Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, executed in 1953 for passing atomic secrets to the Soviet Union. Their conviction was based in part on the work of Angeline Nani and a group of other extraordinary American women. Their persistence and talent brought about one of the greatest counter-espionage triumphs of the Cold War. Venona, the top-secret U.S. effort to break encrypted Soviet spy communications. For nearly 40 years, Angie and several dozen colleagues helped identify those who passed American and Allied secrets to the Soviet Union during and after World War II. Their work unmasked such infamous spies as the British intelligence officer Kim Philby, the British diplomat Donald Maclean, the German-born scientist Klaus Fuchs, and many others. They provided vital intelligence about Soviet tradecraft. Their work was so highly classified that President Harry Truman likely did not know about it. In 1995, when Venona was declassified, the public face of the project was male. The most celebrated name was that of a man, Meredith Gardner, a linguist who deciphered names and words, working closely with FBI agent Robert J. Lamphere. But in the cryptanalytic unit, where the tough analytic math was done, where the messages were prepared and matched, where the breakthroughs happened, where the numbers were so painstakingly stripped, the face of Venona was different. Most of the people working on it were women, says Robert L. Benson, a retired historian for the National Security Agency. The story of Venona's female codebreakers has never been told publicly in full. Benson interviewed some of them for a classified internal history of Venona, only portions of which have been declassified and released online. More important, while the exploits of Gardner and other men have been the focus of entire books, the women themselves did not talk about their work, not to their friends, not to their families, hardly to each other. Most took the secret to their graves. This article is based on exclusive interviews with Nani, the last living member of the original team of Venona women, relatives of codebreakers who are no longer alive, and NSA and CIA publications that detail how the project unfolded. It marks the first time that any of the female Venona codebreakers has given an interview to a reporter. Even now, talking about her career makes Angie Nani nervous. "I still don't if I can help it," she says. She and her colleagues, young women from rural towns, were privy to some of the most closely held secrets of Cold War espionage. In the 1950s and 60s, as the Soviets attempted to learn about U.S. weapons and America was convulsed by the toxic chaos of McCarthyism, these women were among a tiny handful of Americans who knew the truth. They were Gloria Forbes, Mildred Hayes, Carrie Baring, Joe Miller Deffenbaugh, Joan Malone Callahan, Jean Grabeel, and others. Anybody who saw the women together could easily mistake them for a suburban garden club. They wore shift dresses, big hair, fishbowl glasses. They carried handbags. They liked to picnic, shop, play bridge, bowl together. Most started out as school teachers. They had ferocious intellects, a powerful command of languages and math, a steely commitment to public service, and an almost familial devotion to one another. Like Angie Nani, most of them came to Washington during the war and never left. "We were mostly single women," Angie says. "Bachelorhood kind of came with the territory. We were afraid to meet other people because at that time we didn't know who we were going to meet. It might be a Soviet plant. I was even afraid to join a church." Her family heritage is Italian. Trim and elegant, she still has perfect posture, a cherubic face, alert, amused eyes with thin penciled eyebrows. She dresses in La Bella Figura tradition, with startlingly bright gold jewelry and bright, well-tailored clothing. She still cooks for herself, grocery shops, walks every day. And she still lives in the same downtown apartment, exotically decorated with knickknacks she picked up on travels and at antique stores. Gesturing toward her window in the direction of some townhouses where Soviet diplomats used to live, she conjures what Cold War Washington felt like for an unmarried woman who knew some of the government's most sensitive secrets. The Venona messages were encoded in a fiendishly complex system, so difficult to crack that the women mined the same trove for decades, endlessly going over code groups, digging out names, going back and back as new information came to light. At the peak of the Cold War, which was also the peak of the baby boom, an era when American women were urged to spend their lives as homemakers, it was women who started Venona, it was women who kept Venona going, and women who rolled Venona up. To try to break wartime Soviet messages was an act of remarkable optimism, if not hubris. The Russians had a well-earned reputation for creating unbreakable codes, and U.S. codebreakers already had their hands full in deciphering Japanese, German, and other enemy messages. In addition, American leaders were squeamish about reading allies' communications. But the Soviets were unpredictable, and it would be vital to know their intentions in a post-war world. So, on February 1, 1943, the Signal Intelligence Service, the Army's code-breaking branch and a forerunner of the NSA, quietly set up a program to break encoded telegrams sent to Moscow by Soviet diplomats stationed around the world. The collection of intercepts had begun earlier, and somewhat by accident. Starting in 1939, Soviet communications were vacuumed up as a part of a massive Allied effort to intercept transmissions sent by the Germans, Japanese, and other Axis nations. When the United States abruptly entered the war on December 8, 1941, the Office of Censorship began to receive a copy of every international cable. Encoded cables were sent to the Signal Intelligence Service, which by late 1942 was up and running in Arlington Hall, a former girls' school in Arlington, whose gracious grounds had been transformed with barbed wire and massive temporary buildings. There, the Soviet messages accumulated in a wooden file cabinet, and then another, and another. Nobody knew what to do with them, but no crackerjack code-breaking operation throws any message away. By early 1943, the head of Army Intelligence, Carter Clark, had come to distrust the Soviets, ally or not. If they were planning to broker a separate peace with Germany, Clark wanted to be able to warn his bosses. So he made what it is in the annals of code-breaking, a pretty common decision, to try to penetrate an ally's secret communications. He launched a program to read Joe Stalin's mail. At the same time, a bright young home economics teacher was becoming discontented with the charms of rural Southwest Virginia. Jean Gabriel, 23, had grown up in Lee County. Her hometown, Rose Hill, had 300 people, a grocery, a church, and a service station. Her mother raised chickens and sold eggs, and her father farmed tobacco and worked a variety of jobs. The Gabriels had a tradition of sending their girls to college. Jean went to Mars Hill, a two-year school in North Carolina, then to State Teachers College, later called Longwood, in Farmville, Virginia. At the time, the only job a female college graduate could reliably expect was teaching school, and Jean taught home economics to teenage girls in Madison Heights, Virginia. When she told her father she hated it, he urged her to find work that made her happy. At a holiday dance in her hometown during the Christmas season in 1942, she chatted with a childhood acquaintance, Frank Rowlett, who was now a top official in the Signal Intelligence Service. Rowlett confided that there was better work in Washington. By that time, the Army had sent a handful of officers out to seek recruits for its code-breaking operation. Since most of the men were off fighting, the recruiters focused on women. 90% of Arlington Hall code-breakers would be women. Grabeel traveled to the post office in Lynchburg to hand her application for war work to a recruiter named Paavo Carlson. He offered her a job, doing what he could not say because nobody had told him either, and he asked her to head for the Capitol as soon as she could. Grabeel's father agreed she would be happier in Washington shuffling paper for 6 months, her likely task, they both assumed, so she took the job. On Sunday, December 28, 1942, she arrived by train and took a cab to Arlington Hall, where she was given hasty training in the art and science of breaking codes. At Arlington Hall, most work focused on Japanese Army codes, but Gabriel, 4 weeks after arriving, was directed to attack the Soviet intercepts, an immensely secret and sensitive task even in that secret and sensitive place. It's likely she was chosen because Rowlett knew her as a solid citizen with an unimpeachable family background. Her code-breaking partner was Second Lieutenant Leonard Subko, a 1942 Rutgers graduate fresh out of infantry school at Fort Benning. Eager to command troops, Subko later figured he got this job because he was Russian, because he knew Russian. He did not enjoy it. He and Grabeel were seated in one corner of a room and told to speak only in whispers. The other occupant was a British liaison officer, an odd allotment of office space as the British were not to know what was going on. And so Venona began. Two junior analysts laboring at a table in a building that was alternatively hot and cold and always crowded, with huge open bays occupied by teams working on other projects. The first thing Grabeel and Subko did was try to get a grip on what exactly they had. They began sorting the tangle of messages by date as well by lane, the communication circuit over which they had been sent. Before long, Subko was replaced. Other men came and went. Grabeel stayed put. As often happens in code-breaking, enemy countries become an odd sort of ally. Code-breakers in Finland, which the Soviets invaded in 1939, had identified Soviet messages embedded indicators, or special numbers that give clues to how a code system works and what kind of resources, such as code books, had been used to compile it. The Finns passed this tip to the Japanese. And since Arlington Hall was reading Japanese messages, the Finnish gleanings were passed to Grabeel. Using these hints, the former home ec teacher and her colleagues divined that Arlington Hall had messages passing along five different Soviet communication systems. One, the most voluminous, had to do with trade, often about materials being sent from the U.S. to Russia through the Lend-Lease program. Another carried regular diplomatic communications. In time, the codebreakers discerned that the other three were spy systems: GRU, or Military Intelligence, Naval Intelligence, and the NKVD, the forerunner of the KGB. The Soviets' code system was widely considered unbreakable because it had so many layers. To encode a message, a clerk would consult a code book, a kind of dictionary that provided a four-digit code group. Each code group stood for a letter or word. To make snooping much more difficult, those numbers were converted into five-digit figures and then enciphered by adding a second set of numbers known as key or additive. This is where the non-carrying arithmetic came in. The Soviets drew their additives from a one-time pad, pads of pages, each containing about 50 random additives, each page never to be reused. The one-time pad was believed to make the system watertight. That's because breaking a complicated code requires depth, which is the term for lots of messages enciphered using the same page from an additive book. It is depth that enables codebreakers to locate patterns and find a way in. With a one-time pad, there is no depth, no ability to compare. But Arlington Hall had such huge success breaking Japanese and German codes that officials were optimistic. Over the summer of 1943, they funneled fresh recruits into the tiny Russian unit. Josephine Miller arrived in late May. Carrie Barry and Mary Bloke came in mid-July. Helen Bradley in August, Gloria Forbes in September. Virtually all were former educators. Barry later recalled that the salary was $1,800 a year, plus a bonus for Saturday work, twice what she had been making since school. She was an affable and opinionated Texan, adventurous and warm and outgoing, a contrast to her great friend Jean Grabeel, who was tidy and tiny and quiet and stylish. She always looked like she stepped out of a brand box, her sister-in-law Eleanor Grabeel recalls. A member of the Colonial Dames of America and the Daughters of the American Revolution, and later a devotee of University of Virginia basketball. By fall of 1943, the group also included Doris Johnson, Ruby Rowland, Juanita McClutchin, and Rosa Brown. These newly fledged analysts were receiving 2,500 intercepts a week, and the number of file cabinets was increasing. A survey quoted Johnson saying that efficiency was good, no idleness and few complaints or grievances arise, except that, despite all their figuring and matching, their work has been negative in results. In October 1943, the codebreakers began doing machine runs under the supervision of Mary Jo Dunning, a studious, short-haired woman who had been working for the Army codebreaking operation since the late 1930s and knew everything there was to know about how machines could simplify and hasten even the most daunting codebreaking challenge. At this early, laborious brute force stage, they used IBM punch card machines to compare early code groups and thousands of messages that had been sent over trade channels. Thanks to this repetitive, painstaking analysis, the team began to realize that there was, in fact, a tantalizing trace of depth. Some pairs of messages appeared to have been ciphered using the same pad. This insight was the core achievement of Venona. The Soviets had used some of their one-time pads twice. How could the Soviets, so expert at espionage, have committed such a basic blunder? After the Germans invaded Russia on June 22, 1941, entire factories worth of equipment were packed up in Moscow and put on trains to the Urals. Amid the chaos, resources became scant. In desperation, someone decided to manufacture, briefly, some duplicate sets of pads. Soviet spy masters tried to mitigate this weakness by dispersing the duplicate pads. One set might be used by the NKVD unit that was secretly operating out of New York. The second might be used by the Soviet Government Purchasing Commission in Washington. Developing the needle-in-a-haystack ability to match messages traveling through two distinct channels was crucial. If the team could determine that a certain pad used for a routine trade messages had also been used by the NKVD, then a so-called depth of two existed, and they could begin to compare the two. To be sure, two messages wasn't much more when it came to depth. Among code-breaking experts, it had always been assumed that a depth of three, at least, was needed to break a system. But this was a uniquely gifted team. It was Angie Nani who did this vital matching work, looking for buried indicators to figure out which messages, traveling in different channels, might have used the same pad. As they raced to build an understanding of the systems, other breaks were made, sometimes by men, often by women. Samuel Chu, a former English professor at the Citadel, recognized that trade messages tended to use certain words repeatedly and in the same order, usually words having to do with the way commodities and shipping amounts were listed. This greatly helped anticipate what a code group might stand for. Marie Meyer, a Lushan linguist, was particularly good at divining code group meanings. Another big advance came when Genevieve Gratian Feinstein, who had made a major break in a Japanese system in 1940, saw that some opening groups likely revealed which additive page had been used twice. This careful collective labor enabled the team to break the Venona messages using only their analytic powers, unaided by captured code books or supplementary material. It remains one of the greatest feats in the history of U.S. cryptology. By now, the unit had moved into an open area in the back of a temporary building, separated by wooden screens from a team reading weather-related Japanese messages. The codebreakers sat in cast-off chairs at a couple desks and wooden tables. They had a few regular typewriters and one that typed Cyrillic. At the end of the day, they unpit their maps of the Soviet Union from the wall and locked up Russian textbooks. Nobody else at Arlington Hall, which at its height had 8,000 workers, was to know the Soviet code systems were being attacked. In 1945, the American intelligence establishment began to grasp the scope of Soviet spying against the United States. Igor Gozenko, a Soviet code clerk working the GRU system, defected and told Canadian authorities that the Soviets had penetrated the Manhattan Project. Under interrogation by the FBI, Whitaker Chambers, a former GRU agent, named Americans spying for the Soviets. By November, the Truman administration knew of allegations against Lachlan Curry, a White House aide, Duncan Lee, executive assistant at the Office of Strategic Services, forerunner of the CIA, and Assistant Treasury Secretary Harry Dexter White. Around the same time, a former Soviet agent, Elizabeth Bentley, gave the FBI a stunning 107-page statement detailing spies in the State and Treasury Departments, the OSS, the Pentagon, even the White House. The problem was that Bentley had a lot to say, but no documentation to back it up. This is where Venona came in. By the time Angie Nani was brought on in the fall of 1945, one of the few non-college-educated staffers, the section was in high gear. The Russian unit comprised a traffic section, two reading sections, and a back room, a high-level troubleshooting section where Jean Gerbiel was now one of the most experienced workers. "We all love Jean," says Angie, who worked in traffic. "She was very nice, very quiet. A lot of the times, if we weren't sure about something, we felt free enough to go to her." Not everyone was so congenial. A member of the Women's Army Corps, one Lieutenant Hunter, initially tried to keep Nani out of the unit because she lacked a degree. But after Nani proved her mettle, it didn't take long. She encountered Lieutenant Hunter in the ladies' room. "I owe you an apology," the officer said as they were washing their hands. "Apology accepted," Nani said, meaning it, and walked out. She started sorting traffic, but then was assigned to locate messages that involved the reuse of a one-time pad. She would feed certain messages into the key punch machines and hunt for repetitions. Whenever she found one, the entire unit jumped. If you would find a match, you knew what I meant. Everything was just hustle bustle. By 1946, the team had laid the groundwork so that Gardner, a linguist who taught at the University of Akron, could look at code groups to divine what they meant. This was called book breaking, and Gardner was a master. He not only broke words, he broke the spell tables used for encoding English letters. Soon enough, he found himself reading a message from 1944 that identified prominent atomic scientists, including several with the Manhattan Project, who were passing secrets. He read dozens of messages sent between Moscow and New York in 1944 and 1945. Thanks to the spell table, code names emerged, dozens, even hundreds of aliases used to identify spies as well as public figures and projects. Gardner found that Franklin Roosevelt was Capitan. The U.S. War Department was Arsenal, the State Department, the Bank. The Manhattan Project was Enorms, as Elizabeth Bentley was Good Girl. In September 1947, Clark's military intelligence unit quietly shared these successes with the FBI. Gardner began a richly productive liaison with FBI agent Robert Lamphere, who used the Venona material for his investigation, then reciprocated by providing information that sent the Venona team back to read old code groups in light of new findings. The results were startling. For example, an agent was mentioned in the dispatches first by code name Antenna, the beginning in September 1944 by Liberal. In June 1950, the FBI discerned that this information about this agent matched known facts about New York engineer Julius Rosenberg. His wife, Ethel, was implicated in two of the messages. Other translations corroborated what Bentley and Chambers had said. In June 1950, the FBI determined that Ailes was State Department aide Alger Hiss, then serving a sentence for perjury. Jurist was Harry Dexter White, who had died 2 years earlier. Prosecutions were difficult. The cryptanalytic breakthroughs were so sensitive they were withheld as evidence. But sometimes the FBI could produce corroborating information to disguise where the data had originated. This set the pattern for 2 years of investigations and prosecutions. Even as Senator Joseph McCarthy was smearing many innocent Americans, some of the charges he made were true. Likewise, President Harry Truman played down some allegations that were, in fact, on the mark. There is no definitive evidence that he was ever told about Venona. Counterintelligence officials worried that there were spies in the White House. While the nation erupted in finger-pointing and denials, the women in the back rooms of the Venona Project knew what was what and who was who. Whenever a cover name was identified or a major spy operation uncovered, we would all be happy about it and everything, Ann Giannani recalls, but it was all in a day's work. Her nonchalance is remarkable. The work was enormously stressful, potentially world-changing, and crushingly tedious. Many codebreakers suffered breakdowns. Gardner became an alcoholic. Not so the Venona women. Once I walked out of those gates, I would forget about Arlington Hall, Nanny says. That's the only way I could do it. When we would go out and eat and everything, we never discussed work. The extent to which the Venona codebreakers were quarantined stood out even in the top-secret environment of Arlington Hall and later the NSA building in Fort Meade. No one was permitted to enter the Russian unit except for those who worked there, and even that level of security wasn't enough. William Wiseband, a native Russian speaker who had become a U.S. citizen, worked as a linguistic advisor to the unit. He had a tendency to look over his colleagues' shoulders. When I saw him coming in, I would put things over everything she was working on, Nani says. He stopped at my desk and I said, "May I help you?" He took off. Her suspicion was well-founded. Wiseband was, in fact, an NKVD agent. He was identified and suspended in 1950, but never prosecuted for espionage, to preserve what was left of Venona's secrecy. He sold insurance until he died in 1967. But even once the Soviets knew that the Americans cracked Venona, there was nothing they could do about the wartime messages that the Americans already possessed. More names were identified over the next two decades as the FBI provided new leads and women went back to old material. In 1953, the CIA was briefed and began to assist in counterintelligence, enabling more message minding. The two decades between 1960 and 1980 produced hundreds of translations of messages sent in the early 1940s. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, and we'll pick up the rest of this article on our next program. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.